So anyway, last time we spent a bit of time talking about what the Internet of Things was and what it had to do with wireless networks. And then we did a bit of a review of basic networking concepts. So a few key points that came out of that were applications and their data delivery requirements, and how that meshed with delivery over pretty much any sort of network, but in particular wireless networks. Okay. And in particular, the issue you get with wireless is going to be that's maybe a little bit different than other networks is the loss becomes key, since wireless links are not as reliable. Okay, we looked at a history of networking, and we observed that the current networks arose from either voice or packet networks, and even wired networks were developed from that one or the other of those two traditions. And we looked a bit about design of networks. So the idea of creating a circuit, so reserving end-to-end resources versus not doing that, essentially. And then a bit about how to organize all the tasks that need to be done in order to transmit packets. Now, a lot of times, for a lot of this module, we're really mainly worrying about the first link from the user into the network, because that's typically what the wireless link is. And after that, you might be going to go to a much more infrastructure-based network, so either a wired network or a better resourced wireless. We will have a little look at creating networks that are all wireless. Okay, but a lot of what we're doing is the initial link in. Okay, so what we're going to do for the next couple of lectures is look at the particulars of transmitting bits over our radio link. What we're going to look at today is some of the details of just transmitting bits over. It could be any link. And we're going to assume that the physical transmission is wireless. And then next lecture, we're going to look at what are the characteristics of radio transmission as it has it's different from wired transmission. Okay, so most of what's presented today will be found in the Wireless Communications book by Stallings, and that's from chapter 6 and 8. Okay. There are loads of other books that deal with, again, this radio link idea, and it also is a good reference, as is Bruce Black. Goldsmith is quite detailed, and it's very well. It's more details than we're getting in this course. Black does do a lot of discussion of the radio as it applies specifically to cellular systems. Okay. So, again, what we're looking at today is sending digital information from a sender or a source to a receiver or sync. So, a single link, which we assume is physically a radio link. Okay. And we're again assuming what is sent are bits or representations of bits, so digital data. Now, one of the most, or one of the common forms of that data is a voice signal. Voice signals obviously start out as analog signals. Okay, so we will look a little bit about digitized voice signals as well. Okay. So there's a number of steps typically that are gone through. You don't just think here's a bit and send it. But we will transform our bits in a number of different ways into, again, typically a block or a sequence of bits to be transmitted. Okay, so the first thing we'll do is if we have an initial analog signal, so in this case, think voice, we're going to digitize that signal. Okay. So whether it's digitized voice or some other message or data you want to send, you then want to think about how you can send it efficiently. Okay, so you have a digital representation. Is there any, and it's, you know, a certain number of bits to send. You want to send, possibly want to send them at a certain rate. If it's any sort of streaming signal, either voice or video, it needs to be sent at a rate. Is there any way you can compress that, send lower rate information, and still more or less get, recreate your initial signal? Okay. So that's an effort to send as few bits as possible. But then we come up against the reality of bit transmission in general, and in particular wireless bit transmission, which is that it's lossy, so the bits that get sent in at one end of the link aren't necessarily the bits that arrive back out at the other end of the link. Okay. And so we need to think about, well, how are we going to handle that? At a minimum, we need to know that the bits that were sent are not what's received. And if possible, we want to be able to recover what was initially sent from what we received. Okay. The only way you can do this is to add additional bits to your original set. Okay, so this is going to increase the number of bits you have to send while, again, not actually increasing the amount of data you can send. Okay, so then coming out of the channel coder is the block or sequence of bits that you want to send, and you now have to convert those bits into a form that can be transmitted over a radio channel, and that's some sort of sinusoidal form. At least at the moment, we're going to examine what would be the most straightforward, which is sinusoidal forms, which we modify in some way to indicate. And then that sensor gets shipped over the radio channel. Okay. So again, we're going to divide our discussion into two parts. Today, we're going to look at everything except the actual radio channel. And so again, we'll see you transform the bits, so you transform the signal or bits at each stage, and then you have it, of course, unwinded at the receiver. Okay. And so we'll look at each of the pieces sequentially. Okay. So, when discussing these pieces, we're going to also consider the context of performance and how we, again, improve the capacity of the channel by these techniques. And we'll start looking at sort of what are some basic concepts and what are some fundamental limits to what we can do. Okay. So channel capacity indicates that if you're given a certain amount of bandwidth, there is only so many bits you can transmit. You can only get some maximum rate at which you can transmit bits. Okay. Again, depending on the characteristics of the channel and depending on what you do with it, how much redundancy you add, etc., then you will also have a certain error rate. Okay, so you have to expect that your bits aren't all going to arrive correctly. Okay, so we'll have a little look at those concepts and then step through the different blocks and the different techniques that we're going to use to prepare a channel, to prepare data for transmission. Okay. So, again, we can't send an unlimited amount of information in a given, in a fixed amount of time. And this is a fundamental fact. And what limits our capacity to send information is the presence of noise in the system. Okay, so there's a number of sources of noise, and the one that we're going to pay the most attention to is this thermal noise. And this is what's called white noise, and it's distributed uniformly across the spectrum. Okay. And there's a sort of noise density, which is a factor of Boltzmann's constant, for instance, and temperature of the system, and that gives you how much noise is present in a kilohertz. And then, of course, if your spectrum is so many kilohertz, that would give you the noise present across that spectrum. Okay, intermodulation and crosstalk are similar ideas in the sense that signals may interfere with each other. Okay, so if they're being transmitted on overlapping spectra, then they're going to interfere with each other. This will arise later, but again, for the moment, we won't worry too much about that. And then finally, impulse noise. And this is just some unpredictable or irregular pulse. So this is just something that comes along every once in a while and completely obliterates your signal. Again, this is going to be, is going to cause problems, but not really the way we can analyze. So we just assume that there's some sort of unpredictable loss due to that. So again, the noise that we're immediately concerned with is this white noise or thermal noise. Okay. So again, the maximum bit rate of a channel, so the upper bound on how fast we can send our data through a channel, is referred to as the channel capacity, and it's dependent on the bandwidth of the channel, so over what frequencies can you transmit, or what range of frequencies can you transmit, and noise in the form of signal-to-noise ratio. So signal-to-noise ratio is the average signal power relative to the average noise power. Okay. And so Shannon's channel capacity theorem allows us to relate these, and the capacity is given by V log base 2 of 1 plus the signal-to-noise ratio. Okay. This is a theoretical limit. Whether you achieve it or not is based on, again, how you modulate or transmit your form up your bits for transmission, and the actual equipment you're using, etc. Okay, so it's rarely achieved in practice, but it does give you, again, an upper bound on what you can achieve, so there's no point in looking to achieve more than that. Okay. Again, this noise is referring to our thermal noise or our white noise, but often we can in some way map different aspects of our processing as noise factors, which are either going to boost or decrease the signal to noise ratio. Okay. So this is just a little sidebar note. Frequently, the signal to noise ratios and related quantities are expressed as decibels. And a decibel is 10 log 10 of the original quantity. And want to use the non-decibel value, for instance, Shannon Bassett is not the signal to noise ratio, not the decibel value of it, then you have to, if what you're originally given is in decibels, you have to translate it out. Okay. So there's nothing mad complicated about that. It's always worth being careful to see what your quantity is, how your quantity is expressed, and how you need it expressed. Okay. Now we're examining a specific type of signal, a bit, and so frequently we normalize our signal and noise values to the bit specifically. Okay. So we then get EB over NB. 0, where EB is the signal energy per bit, and N0 is the noise over the bandwidth of the bits. Okay. So we start with noise in a specific bandwidth is N0 over T. And then signal energy per bit is S over R, where R is your bit rate. And that gives us that EB over N0 is the signal over the noise times EB over R. Okay. And we can see that by transforming. EB starts out as S over R and goes over N0. And we can transform N0 into N0 T by adding T at the bottom. And then we get S over R and T over N. So where N is N0 will be T. And again, when we move around, we get S over N, and then CT over R. Now, this quantity, or specifically 1 over the quantity, R over T, is what's known as the bandwidth efficiency. And so it's a measure of how well you're using bandwidth. R again, the bit rates that you're packing into as bandwidth. Okay. And so, obviously, the higher R over BT is, the better you're using your bandwidth. Okay, because you're getting more, you're being able to transmit more bits within that specific. Okay. Okay. Similarly, you can relate the channel bandwidth to the theoretical value, your channel capacity. And we can do that using the Shannon capacity theorem. So we unwind and solve for the signal to noise ratio. And then we can relate the signal to noise ratio to E with N0. And doing that, we related E with N0 to spectral efficiency. Okay. So EB over N0 is also related to the error rate, and what the exact relationship is dependent on, again, how you're modulating your bits. Okay. So we have these quantities cycling around through our discussion of this different modules. Okay. So we'll return to that later and look at again mainly modulation. Now, again, the first thing, if we have an analog signal voice, we have to digitize it. So we have an to digital conversion there, and that's what we'll look at, and then we'll move on to encoding. So the main analog signal that we'd be concerned with, again, is the voice signal. And it's typically digitized by sampling and then encoding samples as a sequence of bits. Okay. Now, Nyquist sampling theorem tells us how frequently we should sample the signal in order to reproduce it, and in particular, analog signals can be fully recovered if they're sampled at a rate of twice the signal bandwidth. So your signal is occurring in a certain range. If you sample at twice that frequency, you can recover the signal. The bandwidth for voice is roughly 4,000 hertz. And so we want to sample at twice that rate, so we need 8,000 samples per second. Okay. Now, that sample can occur anywhere on this continuum, but we need to somehow represent the values of the sample in a fixed number of bits, and the number chosen is 8. Bits per sample. Okay. This leads to a 64 kilobit per second voice representation, and that's considered the sort of gold standard for telephony and transmitting voice signals. It's not perfect. We have digitized our sample, so you're not going to get the actual sample value exactly, but you know, you're getting in a reasonably fine range. Okay. Okay. The sampling and digitization of voice is referred to as pulse code modulation. And again, to note, we again do lose a small amount of information in the digitization, and we can encode that into the signal-to-noise ratio, again, for the purposes of calculating then channel capacity. Okay. If I suppose you have a really high-pitched voice and you're going above the 4 kilohertz range, then you know, that just gets lost. Okay, so again, this is a representation of the quantization error, and in fact, you're only able to indicate that your sample is within the range. And so we have an actual value, and that has to be mapped to a code value, and then that code value can be digitized. So in this case, we have 16 code values that are represented by 4 bits, and our actual sample value is then have to be mapped down to an integer number, and then that integer number is sort of represented in binary. Okay. Now, typically the encoding is not necessarily uniform, but rather it's non-linear, with smaller bands near the lower regions of the signal in order to pick up new person else. Okay, so again, that's the gold standard of voice transmission, and you know, again, in your traditional telephony network, that's what was sent, was this 64 kilobit per second stream. Yeah, 64 kilobits per second, you know, now it doesn't seem like a very high data rate, but when we start, when digital cellular phone telephony started, that was quite high. Okay. So, voice signals were further encoded in order to try and reduce the amount of data sent. Okay. Other types of data can also be encoded or compressed in order to reduce the amount of data sent. Okay. And so the process of compressing this data in order to transmit it, be able to send less data, is referred to as source encoding. And there are two options. It can either be lossy or loss-free. And, you know, there's a lot of work on encoding, so you can take any chunk of data and look for a way to represent it more efficiently. We're going to look at a couple examples, namely voice and video. And voice and video are relying on the similarity, typically, between one sample and the next. So the easiest way to make improvements is to look for similarities. Okay, and then if things are quite similar, you don't actually have to send the thing twice. You just send some information about what the difference is. And typically that can be done easier than sending the whole thing. Okay. So, starting with voice, again, we have our 64 kilobit per second baseline. That's sampling and reasonably faithful reproduction. And then we have two basic methods of trying to compress that, trying to reduce the amount of data we're sending. So the first method is what I just mentioned. You look for the similarities, and then instead of sending relatively similar signals, you send the difference between the signals. Okay. And you can get down to quite low rates in that. But yeah, that's something, the continuous variable slope delta modulation only sends sort of an up-down indication. It's very low fidelity and also still has an kilobit per second rate. If you want to go lower, well, you can't. There's nothing really you can do in continuing to modify the original sampled signal, but you have to go to other techniques, which are model-based techniques. And for these, we have a mathematical model of our voice signal with a number of parameters. And so instead of sending the sampled signal, you just send some parameters about the model. Okay. And you can get reasonable voice quality at about 8 kilobits per second. So looking at our differential pulse code modulation, again, the idea is to send not the actual sample, but the difference between the sample, first sample, and the next sample. Okay. And the assumption is that you're not going to go completely from one end of the range to the other end of the range within one sample. It's going to be a more gradual change. So a typical codec will send the difference encoded as 6 kilobits per second, 6 kilobits there, 6 bits. And so you are occasionally going to lose information if the change is too rapid. You can improve slightly by making your sample, your next sample, based on not just the current difference, but also on the previous samples, so you can get trends. Is it going up? Is it going down? Etc. Okay. In this case, we can quantize the difference into 4 bits. And depending on trying to send with his voice or other audio, you can change the quantization levels. Okay. So again, at the other end, the receiver needs to know how the information was encoded and will just decode it. Delta modulation is sort of the ultimate in sort of bit reduction, and so we require that we either go up or down by a specific, we either indicate that we're going up or going down. Okay. And so what you see from the example is that you can roughly trace the shape of the signal, but you are missing the actual values by a fair amount. So, obviously, the accuracy is improved by increasing the sample rate. It's typically thought that you need about 16 kilobit per second, so doubling the sample rate to get an legible or decodable, shall we say, signal. Okay, so this one is used primarily by the military, typically. And a user trying to make a telephone call, for instance, wouldn't think this was acceptable. So, again, all of these modulation techniques were based on trying to encode the sampled signal. Okay. And again, 16 kilobits per second might be about as low as you can drop with that sort of technique. So, again, an effort to improve upon that, we had the different approach approaches were required. Okay. And so the alternative, which is what is used for cellular telephony, is a parameterized model of a sound source, specifically voice source. Okay. And so what we had to do here was we looked at chunks of the signal, and we fit that chunk to our model, and specifically by choosing the parameters of the model. And what is transmitted then is not the actual encoding of the signal, but the parameters for this model. And it's played out according to those parameters. Okay, so the baseline for this is what's called linear predictive coding. And again, you can get down to 4.8 kilobits per second. It's not a good, considered to be a good sound quality, but it would be distinguishable. Okay. So, again, the model would have parameters, loudness, speaking or not, model of the vocal tract, filter all that, and again, what you want, so these parameters are what would be transmitted, and based on those parameters, again, resynthesize a voice signal. Okay. So, if you're talking, you do one thing. If you're not talking, you just send a little bit of, transmit, have a little bit of noise just so it doesn't sound completely dead. And then, again, that's to model the actual speech element. Okay. So that gets you a certain ways. Again, it's considered quite synthetic sounding. It's possible to improve that slightly by adding a code book of what's called residual values, so values that can improve the quality, and so and are likely to be somehow. Okay. So in addition to the parameters before, you'll send index value for this code book, and that value, and those residuals will also be added into our signal. Okay. And so we have what we had before, plus again this code book. Okay, so again, that gets us up to, I think, around 8 kilobits per second signals, and a reasonable voice quality. As I said before, any data can be compressed. Another commonly transmitted form of data is video. And so video is a sequence of images, obviously. And so you can think of any single image as being a collection of pixels, and then you've got sequences of these being transmitted. Okay. Now, since we have a sequence of images, we have two forms of compression possible. We can compress the single image, and then again, we can use redundancy between sequential images to reduce the amount of information we're transmitting. Okay. And so this is referred to as spatial compression. So in a single image, reduce the number of bits, and then temporal compression. So reduce the amount of information you have to send from one image to the next. So, again, spatial coding relies on redundancy in the image. So as you can see here, you have a whole strip at the top, and as you go across, it's pretty much the same pixel. It's the same color. Okay. So you could send that, you could encode the pixel and send that however many times, or you can encode the pixel and then say how many times does it repeat. Okay. And if you have an image like this, you can see that a single pixel is really repeating quite a few times. So if you're going to reduce the size of the representation of a single image. Okay. You can also see that between any two images, there will be some small change, but it's not huge. Okay. From image to image to image, you're only changing a little bit. So again, you're undoubtedly going to save by just indicating where the changes are. Presumably this figure is moved a tiny bit, so pixels around the figure will change. Everything here, it's the same as it was before. So again, instead of, like with voice, don't send sample, send the change in the sample, don't send the pictures, just indicate the changes in the picture. Okay. So, there are, again, two versions, constant bit rate, which would just, have a payload of bits and, encode to fit in a payload, and variable bit rate, where you would, try and compress the amount of data as much as possible using both spatial and temporal coding. Okay, and the main standards for video encoding are the MPEG standards, and again, they have different ways of doing it depending on which standard. So that's voice, that's video. Again, one similar idea is using the changes between successive pieces of data. Your initial encoding for video is more complex and does allow for more compression. Any data can be compressed, then there's a lot of work done on just, here's a collection of bits I know nothing about. How can I compress it? And you can. Just any collection of bits, typically there are ways of compressing it into a smaller collection of bits. But again, unless signals that we understand the characteristics of, like voice and video, we can have specific heuristic type techniques that we understand and allow us to improve or reduce our bit rate. Okay. So, source encoding is going to reduce the bitrate at which we have to send, so reduce the typically in terms of sort of streaming media. The next thing that we have to consider, again, is we're sending this data, and we place some value on the data, and therefore we have to have some scheme for dealing with it if something goes wrong. Okay. And so, first of all, you have some way of determining if something goes wrong. And secondly, we might want to try and fix the problem if something goes wrong. So, doing this is handled by channel encoding. And so again, the goal is to detect or correct the errors. And you must add additional information to the bits you're sending. Okay. You'll see several ways of doing this, but you can't. If you don't have any additional information, there's nothing you can do. So, I really should really detected errors are handled in one of three ways. I say two here. Well, you can always just do nothing. You can always just say, well, I've lost that bit of information. Too bad, move on. Okay. If you want to recover the information, then there are two things you can do. You can request the information again, or if you've added sufficient information, then there may be some way you can actually fix the problem that you have. Okay. So if you think, for instance, about our voice signal or our video signal, asking to resend the information probably isn't going to be terribly useful, particularly in voice, because it needs to play out shortly after it's been received within the context of the stream. And so if a sample doesn't get there, then there's no point. By the time a second version got there, you know, the stream would have moved on. Okay. The human ear is very good at compensating for missing bits of data, so you know, we can just play it out, or possibly, again, we can have some scheme to correct it and make the signal slightly better, or the data stream slightly more accurate. Okay. Depending on sort of how loss in your channel is, and this becomes more and more important. One thing to note, actually, and we'll come back to it, is that if the channel is too bad, if you're losing too much information, then think about it. Actually, all your coding can make the situation even worse. Okay. And oh, dear. Okay, so apologies, but I seem to misplace the slide. Basically, how can you do this coding now? And again, we're going to look at two different flavors. One is to encode a block of data. Okay, and when I say encode, what I mean is I'm going to add, and I'm going to take the data, even if it's a stream, I'm going to chunk it up into blocks. And for each block, I'm going to add some redundancy, some additional bits. Okay, that's block coding. A second method then would be to take the stream of data and somehow encode the stream as you go along. And so this is a more sophisticated method of encoding, and what it does is actually pulls in a history of the data you're sending. So if you examine a chunk of data at the other end, then there's some relation between that and the next bit and the next chunk and the next chunk. So you have your encoding is spread out over. A longer sequence, and this improves what you can do. So typically, block coding is only used to detect errors. Yeah. If you really work at it, you might be able to correct errors, but we're typically only going to use block coding to detect errors. Then we can use encoding of streams to correct errors as well as detect them. So we divide our data into blocks, we add redundancy bits to those blocks. And we use that redundancy to detect errors. If we do detect an error, we either have to dump the block, or we always have to dump the block. We can either ask for that information to be resent or not, depending on what our application is. Block coding falls into two categories, more or less. Parity codes and cyclic redundancy checks or codes. Okay. Parity codes are nice because they're easy. And so what a parity check does is it's going to detect single bit errors. Okay. And so in particular, and we add only one more bit to our block. It's a low overhead. What that bit does is it makes the number of bits of the certain that is to zero. So in here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 zeros, we add another one and we take zeros. Now, suppose a bit changes. If the 1 changes to a 0, what if 8 zeros, add 1 and 9? So you know that that's wrong. If 1 zeros changes, you know that 6 zeros. The problem is, now, change any two bits, so change 0 to 1 and 1 to 0, the number of zeros is still are the same, and therefore, again, doesn't check the error. So it's good, again, if you have single bit errors, as you would get with more white noise. It's not as good with what's called burst errors, where you might have sequences of bits at a time. We can improve on that somewhat by having two-dimensional parity checks. So here we divide our block up into sub-blocks, and we do, and think of it as now a matrix, and we do parity checks both up, parity checks both up and down. Now, it's possible in this case to correct single bit errors, but the problem is, again, if you get multiple errors, if you get more than one error, then you may actually arrive at a situation where you're correcting the wrong thing, or you can't do a correction. So it's not terribly useful for the correction of errors, but just, you know, it is theoretically possible. Okay. So, in terms of detecting errors, the cyclic redundancy check is much more reliable, and again, doesn't require you to send a whole lot of extra information. So we can have D data bits, and what we apply let's call the generator function G to these bits with the goal of choosing remainders that so that the D ended by the remainder is divisible by G, and this division is modulo 2. So the sender will generate these remainders. The receiver knows G by which code was generated. And so all the sender has to do is divide what's received and check that it actually divides in evenly. Okay. And so if the generator is sort of R+1, then obviously the remainder is one bit less than that in size. And we can detect all burst errors of less than less in length. And you know, this is again why we use, because you don't have to add a whole pile of redundancy, and yet you get good detection. So the other nice thing about it is that we can implement it as a logic function, a bunch of XORs, and therefore it can actually all be done in hardware. Okay, so this makes it fast. And so again, what we're trying to do is at the sender, we're going to generate our remainder, and then the receiver we're going to find check that we don't have our remainder. Okay. So because all of our operations can be done as an XOR, so exclusive OR is 0 if the bits are the same and 1 if the bits are different, and that's the mathematics that we use. it's relatively easy to do. Okay. So here we're trying to generate our remainder, and so we start with one, which gives us the passing one here. So x over 1 is 0, here at 1, here we have 1. Obviously, 1 over 1 isn't going to go into that. So I think this is going to just pop now. Okay. So 0 here, add a 0. Now, this will actually go in, so we end up with 0, 1. It goes in 0 until we get that here. That is the reason that 1 doesn't go into that, so 1, 0, 0, 0, I should say, it doesn't go into that. Have a remainder of one, zero, zero, zero. That doesn't. Okay. And so the conclusion we draw from that is that we are not. Do not know that there has been an error. Okay, so that's that. So that's dividing things up into blocks. Our second method is to somehow encode a continuous stream of data. Okay. And obviously that's only useful if your data comes in streams, so it can be used for things like voice and video. The benefits of this approach is that not only can we detect errors, but we can perform forward error correction as well, so we can correct some errors. And again, this can be done relatively easily. We're going to operate now on data streams, not blocks. And we do the coding on a fixed number of bits. Can either be frequently well encoding one bit at a time. For the number of bits we're encoding, we produce an output block. So here for each bit, we produce, for example, 2 bits coming out. Those bits are produced based on our current block, but also on previous historical blocks. Okay. And so, again, that means that you have some memory in the system you're encoding, not just single block, but a sequence of blocks. Just notationally, these encoders are characterized according to the size of the block they encode, that's K in the middle, the number of code bits that are generated per block, and so that's N, and then the history in the amount of previous blocks that are examined to be encoded. So that means that, okay, so a block to encode is 1. It's actually going to get encoded into 3 separate outputs, okay, because it's the primary piece of data in 1, and it's also secondary for regularly having traditional information you're sending to do the encounter. Now, again, the block encoding is sort of intuitive. This is a bit less so. So I think I'm going to take the break here so we can have a little breather, and then we'll continue on with that idea after the break. So the usual 15-ish minutes, and then we'll be back.